Let's resume our study of the book of Daniel, chapter number 11. We're going to start at verse 21 in just a moment. This is Daniel's last prophetic writing. This is the end of his recorded ministry. It is a vision that he has in the year 535 BC. In the spring of that year, he went on a three-month fast. He was upset, probably because work on the rebuilding of the temple had been disrupted, had stopped, and he wanted to know what did the future hold. So God sends an angelic messenger to give him a glimpse into the next several hundred years of Jewish history. And so we've already gone over part of that precise history. The biggest part of it, though, zeroes in on a great crisis that happens in the Jewish faith in the 2nd century BC, when even some of the ethnic Israelis themselves abandon the faith of the Mosaic Covenant and start taking on the Greek religion and Greek lifestyle. And this is very frustrating to God's purpose of the Jewish people being a light to the Gentiles and bringing the Messiah in through them. Now, the main bad guy during this crisis time is Antiochus IV, who comes to power in 175 BC and then dies very early in 163 BC. His story in this prophecy starts in chapter 11, verse 21. So let's reprise some of that and then push forward. Verse 21 says, "In his place shall arise a contemptible person." That's Antiochus. He's contemptible. "To whom royal majesty has not been given." I want you to definitely highlight that. "When his brother died, Antiochus stole the throne from his 10-year-old nephew, Demetrius I, who was way off in Rome, serving as a political hostage, so that the Jewish, the Macedonian Greeks of Syria would behave themselves according to the dictates of the Roman Treaty of Apamea. And so Antiochus IV is a usurper king, and that's exactly what was predicted here a couple hundred years previous. But it goes on to say this: "He shall come in without warning," and it did. It happened really fast. "And obtain the kingdom by flatteries." So he starts schmoozing his fellow Macedonians and the Jewish religious people that were willing to give up their covenant religion in favor of Greek religion. And this is all recorded, by the way, in the writings of 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, and Josephus also talks about it, that many of the Jewish people of this time period became renegades of the true faith. They started Hellenizing. Hellene is actually the way the Greeks talk about themselves. So this is what was happening. The Jewish people, many of them, were trying to become Greek-like. And Antiochus IV plays on that desire and makes alliances with those types of renegade Jews. Verse 22, "Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant." So he even compromises the high priesthood. He actually puts into the high priesthood high priests that were wanting to Hellenize or make more Greek-like Jewish people. Then verse number 23. "And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. The alliance we're talking about here is between the Jewish people and him. And he shall become strong with a small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province. He shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power in his heart against the king of the south. That would be the Ptolemaic kingdom of Egypt. With a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. So when Antiochus invades Egypt in 170 BC, the kingdom pretty much rolls over for him. Ptolemy VI, who is the Macedonian leader there, is not able to hold him off. So then what happens? Well, he's pretty much taken over Egypt, and now he wants to withdraw and go back and take care of other business. So he makes deals with Ptolemy VI, and that's mentioned right here, verse 27. As for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. Now, the end that's referenced here is not the end of the world. It's going to be the end of the crisis that we're talking about. The end of the Macedonian domination of the Jewish people, and particularly the Jewish faith. That's going to be terminated in the 2nd century BC. Verse 28. He shall return to his own land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. So when he is heading back north again, having made some sort of treaty with Ptolemy VI, Antiochus stops by Jerusalem and continues to cause trouble for the truly religious Jews. He does not like the Jews that are maintaining their separation from everybody else. He doesn't like circumcision. He doesn't like the kosher laws. He doesn't like the fact that they don't worship the same Greek gods everybody else in his kingdom worships. So he is starting to develop in his mind this need to annihilate Judaism as a religion. Verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. So he reinvades Egypt in 168 because when he left, he didn't have full control of the capital city of Alexandria. So he rethinks that and decides, I really need to go down there and make it clear to them that their kingdom has been absorbed into my kingdom. Well, something's happened in the meantime. Ptolemy VI has reached out to the Romans and asked them to come and save Egypt from the Syrian Macedonian invasion of Antiochus IV. I'm sure it went something like this. Great Senate of the Romans, power players in the Mediterranean world. We are your breadbasket. We supply a lot of the grain for your growing capital city of Rome and for your empire. You won't have access to that if Antiochus IV takes us over. You need to come and fight him off. Now, you may have remembered that the Greek Syrians, Antiochus IV and all his people, are already involved in the Treaty of Apamea with the Romans, where they were forced to pull back into to the total eastern end of the Mediterranean basin, and to limit how many elephants they have, how many warships they have in the Mediterranean, and where those warships can go. They even have to provide political hostages of the royal family to the Senate at Rome as a means of keeping the deal with the Treaty of Apamea. And they also have to pay a certain amount of money as war reparations every year. So the Romans and the Syrian Macedonians don't get along at all already. So when the Egyptian Ptolemaic kingdom reaches out to Rome, the Senate sends a formal consul, somebody that used to serve as the top leader, with an army. And this guy meets Antiochus IV at the border of Egypt and tells him, you may not come any farther. In fact, you have to withdraw all your forces beyond a certain line down in the south part of the eastern Mediterranean. So effectively, the Roman Senate, through this guy, is limiting the Macedonian-Syrian Empire even more. And Antiochus was asking that he could have more time to think about this before he agreed. And the Roman general just simply took a stick and drew a circle in the sand around him and said, no, I want your answer before you cross that line in the sand. And that's where we get that term. Well, he gives up and decides that he can't take on the Roman Republic. So he is afraid and he withdraws. Verse 30, for ships of Kittim shall come against him. That would be the Roman Navy near Cyprus and even south of Cyprus. So he's afraid of the naval power of Rome, and he's also afraid of their land forces that come out of that navy. He shall be afraid and withdraw, so he pulls back from his attempt to finish his invasion of Egypt. And as he does so, he's enraged. He is steamed. He is mad. And that's when he gets word that there's a Jewish religious revolt against him in Jerusalem. They had actually tried to disrupt the pro-Antioch high priesthood that was already in place. So he goes to Rome. He goes to Jerusalem. He takes action against the Holy Covenant. And then he shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So at this point, in 168, he kills those that were revolting against him. He replaces in power the high priesthood that is pro-Greek, pro-Macedonian. And then he goes back to Syria and steams for a while. He's very mad about everything that he wants to do being disrupted. And then, verse 31, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress and shall take away the regular burnt offering. Now, this is where the history gets exceptionally precise. The following year, 167, right before Pentecost, right, actually in association with Pentecost weekend, he sends one of his representatives to Jerusalem to pretend that he wants to live in peace with the religious Jews. And then when they are having their Sabbath day, preparing for Pentecost of that year, and they can't fight back according to their traditions, this representative of Antiochus IV attacks and kills tens of thousands of religious Jews at Jerusalem and disrupts their Pentecost celebrations. That's the beginning of his campaign, his very aggressive campaign against the Jewish faith. Then a few months later, he actually puts out an order. Sacrifices by religious Jews at the Jerusalem temple have to stop completely. That's the taking away the regular burnt offering. No morning and afternoon sacrifices anymore. In addition to that, he says, there will be no more circumcisions. If you circumcise your child, I will execute you. There will be no more of your religious books being read and spread around. So if you are caught with a book that is of your religious books, you will be burned with it. And so all of this starts within the late spring through the summer and into the fall of 167. And then right at the end of the fall, getting to move toward winter, in the ninth month of the Jewish calendar, Antiochus has his representatives set up a Greek-style altar on the top of the Jewish altar of sacrifice at the temple. And then on the 25th day of that same month, in the middle of December of 167 BC, a dedication sacrifice of a pig, a female pig, is offered there to dedicate that temple to Zeus. And this is the abomination of desolation. It says right here that they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. That's what happened in December of 167. And that's all under Antiochus. Verse 32, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. So he's all fine with ethnic Israelis that have abandoned the Jewish covenant. And there was a ton of them that did that. But he is trying to eradicate anyone that is committed to the Mosaic law. And this passage is specifically to help them get through that crisis. It says here, the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. The wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help. Many shall join themselves to them with flattery, and some of the wise shall stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. So this begins the centerpiece of the great crisis of the second century BC for the Jewish religious faith. Antiochus IV tries to wipe it out. He sends enforcement patrols all over the Jewish lands. These enforcement patrols go to a city. They set up an altar of sacrifice that's styled after a Greek sacrifice altar. And then they sacrifice a pig and require that every Jewish person come and eat the sacrificial pork as a clear indicator that they've abandoned their Jewish ways, that they have decided to become Greeks. One particular family revolted against that in their town called Medine. This was the Hasmonean family. The father was a man by the name of Mattathias. His son, though, is much more famous for us. That is Judas Maccabee. This family became the match that set afire the great Jewish resistance movement against the attempt to totally annihilate the Jewish faith in the second century BC. And after 3 years of fighting and the loss of a lot of people, Judas Maccabee took back the Temple Mount. He cleansed the temple. And on the anniversary of the abomination of desolation being set up, that is on the 25th day of the ninth Jewish month, 3 years later, December of 164 BC, he rededicated the temple and reinitialized the daily sacrifices, morning and evening, and all the other sacrifices that go along with the Jewish faith. That's the holiday of Hanukkah, how it got started, the feast of rededication, as it's referred to in the Gospel of John. And so that's the end of the crisis, the immediate core of the crisis, which is talked about right here in the prophecies of Daniel several centuries earlier. Now, that did not totally end all the troubles of the religious Jews, because the Greeks still continued and the renegade Jews still continued to win against Judas Maccabees and his brothers. But eventually, Antiochus IV dies. And once he is dead, the anti-Jewish movement lost a lot of its steam. Now, we still have some more prophecy here, though. And that is where I want to go next. Because in verse number 36, a lot of the commentators will say this jumps forward in time to the book of Revelation, to the time right before Jesus comes back, that this is a description of what is usually referred to as the Antichrist and his activities. They'll say that this doesn't match anything from ancient times, and that's why it has to have something to do with the future. Well, I disagree with that assessment. I think the rest of the material here in this chapter is about the resolution of the crisis the rest of the way in the second century. And so I'm going to share with you what I think the historical tie-ins are. So in verse number 36, it says, "The king shall do as he wills." Now, I believe this is the king that comes up after the death of Antiochus IV. I believe that this king is actually Demetrius I, the young nephew that Antiochus IV had usurped. Remember, this guy was clear off in Rome and he was only 10 years old. Well, in 163, when Antiochus dies, Demetrius finds out about that, and he immediately gets a military force together and comes to the Middle East from Rome to claim his heritage, to claim his usurped throne. And so he arrives in 162 BC. So the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what a decree shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the God of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. That one beloved by women is probably a reference to the Messiah, because remember in the book of Genesis, it was the seed of woman that was going to save all of us. And so the Jewish people were constantly looking for the seed of woman to be the Messiah. All right, so he shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. Those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land for a price. So this guy is coming in, having been raised up in Rome, having been raised far away from the Middle East. So he's got a totally different perspective. And he thinks that he is strong by the power of foreign gods. And he hates Judaism just as his uncle did. That's the one thing they probably would have agreed on. And so he continues this fight against the religious Jews. Verse number 40, at the time of the end, meaning the full end of the crisis, that is, when the Jewish people will no longer have the Macedonian Greeks of Syria in control of them. So at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. So that's Ptolemy the VI, who immediately attacks Demetrius I whenever he arrives in country. But then we have a little twist. But the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and many ships. Now that is a reference to Alexander, who was the son of the late Antiochus IV, and therefore Demetrius I's cousin. So he's the guy that, upon his father's death, actually claimed to be the new king of the north. And so we've got this new guy coming from Rome, Demetrius, and he's being attacked both by the Ptolemaid king and the Seleucid king, both the king of the south and the king of the north, because he is disrupting the apple cart, if you will. He shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land, and tens of thousands shall fall, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. So Alexander does end up defeating Demetrius and taking over all of the northern half of the Middle East. Now, he never gets control of Edom or Moab or Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So he does fight against Egypt as well. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. So he finds out that he's got other contenders through the throne that are coming his direction. And so he goes out to fight them, but runs into problems. He shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. So when it's all said and done, Demetrius I also goes down. And that results eventually in the Jewish religious people securing their independence.